and welcome to Podcast DX, the show that brings you interviews with people just like you whose lives were forever changed by a medical diagnosis. I'm Jean Marie. Ron will not be joining us today. He's practicing archery.
And I'm Lita. Today's conversation is deeply personal and deeply human. We're talking about cancer, and more specifically, what it means to be an emergency physician living with stage 4 cancer.
Our guest today is James Muskelk, whose perspective on illness changed dramatically when he became a patient himself. Good morning, doctor. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Thank you. I have a day off today. It's lovely to be able to talk to you.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you for joining us.
When you went from being a patient, or a physician, sorry, to being a patient, how did that change your perspective on things, and how did that occur?
Well, do you ever feel like you're waiting for something to begin, but you don't know what it is?
Sure, like you're on the brink of, yes.
Yeah, like of a discovery.
On the precipice,
okay,
yes.
Financial security, a relationship that's giving me everything I need, or whatever. This almost like, what's a better word, like pregnancy of the moment that's going to deliver you finally into some new world that makes a certain type of sense. Mm-hmm. And that moment happened to me when the ENT surgeon stuck a needle into my neck. And it was COVID phase one, leading out of just phase one. And, you know, by the way, we were standing there in the ER thinking that virus is going to kill us, right? Because we're mm-hmm. seeing what's coming out of Italy. But it wasn't very busy in the ER. And one day I was just sitting there and, you know, a bit of a sore throat, you know, trying to figure out, oh, do I have strep throat? Is it a virus? Is it COVID? And then I felt this lymph node on one side of my neck. And, you know, right away I'm like, oh, I'm a catastrophist, right? It's my job to predict catastrophe in people. So I was catastrophized right away. Mm-hmm. And I called the surgeon and she said, oh, you know what? I'm just finishing my first clinic in like 3 months, I guess, right? Because we're talking spring 2020. My first clinic in several months. I'm sure it's nothing. Just come upstairs. And so then she felt my neck and she probably had more specificity than me. And she grew a look of concern, then came back with, in my mind, a very large needle, but it probably was a very small needle, and then just stuck it into my neck. And then I'm like, oh, this is it. The plot mm-hmm. has caught up to me.
Okay. Well, the shift in your attitude was obviously profound, because you weren't really sure, and now you had an impending doom feeling, or?
Yep. You know, at that time, you know, I think it is this, you know, as I describe what happens, and maybe your listeners or maybe you have even been through something like this, is that when you understand that mortality is yours too, you know, mm-hmm. even if I've seen many people die, probably more than most people even, you know, palliative care docs, obviously, more, but I mean, I work with Doctors Without Borders, and I worked in places where I saw like 5-year-olds die or 3-year-olds, and there was actually no real reprieve of any age group where they weren't. Mm-hmm. So it was just, that's just reality, right? So I was at the bedside a lot and, you know, trying to help those people and honor them if I couldn't help them, etc. But it doesn't prepare you for when life taps you on the shoulder and says, no, you too. Mm-hmm. You're like, what?
Right, right.
I thought I was maybe going to be the one to make it out of this place. But no, you know, there is a fine and private place there waiting for us
sure.
as well.
We have a doorway to go through.
Yeah, you know, and there's that, try to remember that I'm still living, right? That's very mm-hmm. important. At this mm-hmm. point, even though you can kind of, your mind starts to puzzle over, you know, our minds only want to reckon with what they can't understand. The future, unanticipated future, why that person cut me off in traffic, you know, et cetera, right? But when this it tangles with this very big thing that is death or dying or illness or decline, it becomes this very, it's hard not to let that carry in, like seep into all aspects of your life and sure. become, you know, make it as like a puzzle that you're worrying about all the time and fundamentally, you know, reckoning with all the time. But as we do it, or as I did it, my experiences, and thankfully I've been given years, right? Like I've that's like, what are we now? Six, almost coming up 6 years. Mm-hmm. So I have had the gift of time. But it is like someone turns the volume knob up a little bit, or the volume, the color knob, meaning everything is a little bit more precious. And mm-hmm. when that, my experience of that is that things like resentment, anger, those kind of more petty feelings that you can kind of carry, or grudges, you know, those are, there's no space for that in my life anymore. I don't have make time for it.
Okay.
And that's just such a wonderful clarifying position as a physician and as a person. For me, that just shows that life overall has something like a trajectory. Mm-hmm. That as you embrace your own finitude, I suppose, then there is this kind of clarifying, non-harming thing that arises within us. And that's mm-hmm. just really beautiful to be a part of. I feel in some ways grateful for that knowledge. Although I would, if you could tell me you had a medicine to get me rid of it, I'd take it.
Oh, sure.
Of course.
Now, you sound like a very young man.
I just act like it.
Okay. All right.
Young at heart at the very least.
Are you a family man already?
I don't, you know, I don't know if I'll get to it this time around. I haven't had children. I feel like that's but aside from that, I very much am a family man. You know, I'm really close to my parents, my brother, my niece and my nephew. And as that goes, isn't it? Now I feel like I took care of my mom as she was dying, you know, and I held her like she was a baby. Mm-hmm. And that is that symmetry of life, isn't it? We get to help those who helped us, don't we?
Right, mm-hmm. right. Yeah, we see that a lot.
Mm-hmm. And I know this is going to sound a little bit bizarre, but as someone, I'm not, you know, cannot put myself in your shoes, but I have had points where I've been told that things are rather dire. And then I've come out of surgery to find out that, you know, like I coded during surgery. Whoa. And things of that nature. And I have to say that in my opinion, you know, how you were saying that, you know, you don't have time for resentment and everything. It's almost, and this is going to sound utterly bizarre, but almost freeing mm-hmm. to have that sense of mortality, because you realize that the only thing that, you know, you can make a difference in so many ways. And that, you know, the things that you do have that ripple on effect, and that you can help others and affect change in some regards. And then there are things that you have no control over, and that you kind of have to let those things go. And so it can be, I mean, it's once you process all of everything, it can be a kind of freeing, but in a very odd way.
Yeah, I think that's you described it so well. And that's what I mean about that thing we're waiting to start. I wish mm-hmm. I could recall the person who said it, and I hope I get their words at least partly right. But, you know, we get two lives, and mm-hmm. the second one starts when we realize we only have the one. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. and there's that preciousness that is imbued. And I was talking to a friend of mine who, at an even younger age than me, was diagnosed with metastatic cancer, and in her 30s. And we were both pretty early on in our diagnosis, but she a little more experienced than me. And she said, you know, if you could take this cancer away, I would be so grateful. But if the insights that it gave me left with it, I would refuse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Even though it would be the death of her.
Because it was
and,
so
and
life.
And still may be.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I think there's that, you know, what we're kind of pointing at here is that non-harming, loving nature that mm-hmm. lives within us. And I think that we're hopefully battling our way out of at some point, you know, in our human trajectory. I mean, as overall, as a species of highly anxious and animals with a seemingly limitless appetite, I like to believe that what is working through us is a process that is thousands of human generations long, that mm-hmm. is as beautiful as a sequoia tree or any other thing that nature makes, because it can only ever make complex and beautiful things. And as we have conversations like you and I are having, and we talk about death and dying and what that means for life and living, I think we have that chance to talk about what really matters the most.
Right.
And
right.
how to stay close to God, whatever that means to you. Okay, I'm not going to get into that. But yeah, get close to God and stay there is what, when people ask me about the advice, that's what I would give them. You know, whatever that means to you. For me, mm-hmm. it's like nature and science. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it can mean different things to different people, different gateways, different doors, as you said.
And we understand that, you know, different people, different patients will experience illness differently. And illness is not just like a neat little problem that you can put in a cube.
But how did your training as an emergency physician affect how you reacted to your diagnoses?
You know, I had a lot of compassion for patients who aren't doctors going through this mm-hmm. because it is complicated. It's very complex mm-hmm. and it's very complicated to be sick. And we don't do a good job of telling you what's going on. And we don't do a good job of making you feel safe. I'm really sorry. But that, you know, I'm saying that on behalf of my profession. I'm so sorry. Because it's confusing. It's terrifying. There's very little compassion a lot of the time along the way. You don't really know who to turn to. Like those, does that ring a bell to any of you? I mean, I hope so. I hope not, but I suspect it does. So there's that point of like, do I really have to doctor myself through this? Can't I just fall back into the patient side? And there are instances and people who let me do that. I'm so grateful to them, many of my care providers. But there were other doctors who didn't really seem that interested and couldn't, you know, the proverbial one foot out the door approach to patient care.
Well, yeah, you know what? As you were talking, it was kind of hitting me. Nowadays, we have about 3 or 4 minutes with our physicians. Mm-hmm. And I was curious, when you're talking to a physician and you're talking about something that is going to be your final disease, do they give you more time than that 3 or 4 minutes?
You know, it depends. Not really. You know, unfortunately, it's a bit doubly, it's what I would say, an observational bias. Because I don't know what it's like to not be a doctor. And by the way, I drop it right away. You know what I mean? I mean, I'll let people know that I know what's up, because mm-hmm. just so they can start speaking to me. I'm not trying to boss them or anything, although I sometimes will say, I'm a doctor, give me more pain medicines. I can handle it or whatever. Or, you know, I kind of know that the criteria, and I'm in, you know, an 8 out of 10 pain scale or whatever makes them, you know, I can let them know that I understand the language. But I'm kind of waiting that they would take special care of me. And I think that to some extent they did. But there's this study that I keep coming back to, and it's about compassion. And they asked oncologists, who probably should be the best at this, right? Because they're mm-hmm. dealing with right. conversations of people kind of on their worst day a lot of the time. And they did a survey to all these oncologists and said, why, you know, it's been shown that if you spend some time with a patient talking to them and saying, you know, this script of, you know, saying, I'm sorry, this has happened to you. We're going to get through this no matter what it is. We'll get you the best care possible. Any hesitations or things that are unclear, please let me know. That it dropped anxiety better than an antidepressant would or any other sedative would, any other medicines. So just that simple intervention. When you asked oncologists why they didn't do it, they said they didn't have enough time. Mm-hmm. But the script is 75 seconds long. Mm-hmm. Right? They yeah. showed the script, but it's 75 seconds. But the number one reason why when oncologists were surveyed about why they didn't do that, it was because they didn't have enough time. But that's not the actual case. They do have the time. And I don't know. I think that it is vulnerable, maybe. Mm-hmm. There's a strategy that's afoot in medicine, which I decry, which is, okay, I'm just going to hold something very human back from me, from you. Mm-hmm. And that's going to make it easier for me.
Right. Right.
To deliver the bad news.
Right.
But the better way to do it is to put your hand on their knee if that feels like that's something that they want and would value. Some people want human touch and other people don't. You should, a doctor, good doctor, should try to pick up on that. Mm-hmm. And say, I'm so sorry. This must be so hard for you. Mm-hmm. And then they'll start to cry a little bit. And then maybe you start to cry a little bit. And then that's because you're connected. Human beings are connected. And when you realize that, and then you say, don't worry about a thing. We're going to get the CT scan. We'll figure out what's next. And if there's nothing next and we can't do anything, we're going to make sure you're in control and you have a beautiful, the remainder of your life is as beautiful as possible. And it just means so much to you and to them. You can walk out of that room and feel like, wow, I wouldn't want any other job in the world.
How do you compare that to your work as an emergency care physician? When you had to deal with patients that came in that might have been too far gone, and now you have to talk to the family members of those patients. Would you compare the two?
Yeah, oh, very much so. Absolutely. Absolutely. I had a patient. I do, you know, virtual medicine is a thing too, right? In the last 4 or 5 years, I don't know if you've talked to your doctors on Zoom or the equivalent of it, but it is something that more of us are doing because, you know, we get to do it from home, and it's kind of it can be enjoyable to save patients the time and come to them a little bit. It's almost like the old version of the doctor on a horse kind of thing, but, you know, minus the horse. And I was on call, and I got this, my phone started to ring, which is rare. Usually they text me and then I just call them back. But my phone started to ring. And so I picked it up, and it was a video call. And these nurses on frantic on the other end were trying to resuscitate infant. Mm-hmm. And it was unsuccessful. So the mm-hmm. baby died, the child died. And they handed me the phone to the grieving father. And, you know, I was just staring at this distraught man and just said to him, I wish I was there with you because I could hug you. And, you know, virtual medicine is about, I was sincere. You know, I think that's for me the best part of my job. Like, I don't like patients who die, right? I mean, I love science and I love resuscitation science and I want to be there people for everyone and with as much skill and integrity. I'm so glad to work at the hospitals I do. We are awesome at it. But, you know, nature has its way about her, right? And not everyone is going to, you know, make it. So I love, maybe the second part of the job I love the most besides being there and succeeding is just being there with people overall and letting them know that they're cared for and that you just have that moment of connection. So overall, it is very similar. You know, those discussions are best done with 2 feet in the door, in my opinion.
Okay. And how did becoming a patient change your understanding of shared decision-making between the patient and the doctor?
Yeah, I think, again, I have an advantage here because I can look at the science and I know how it feels in my body and I know what clinical decision making is. And I'll confess something, that I have decreased the cadence of my follow-ups because they make me anxious. And I did this with my oncologist, by the way. I didn't like just, you know, renegade, say I'm not coming in for the CT scans or the blood work. But I did say, if there is an option to do them less frequently, I would take it. And if you think that that's foolhardy, you know, I don't want to die a fool, so you just tell me. But I also know that medicine can be inclined to investigate, and it can be inclined to over-investigate, and it can be inclined to get data points that don't figure what we call clinically, meaning it's not going to trigger a decision point. I'll give you, you know, I'll be a little bit more clear, is that, so let's say I do this hormone level of this cancer that's somewhere in my body, right? It's slowly going up. But if they do the CT scan, which I just had a full complement of CT scans, like head to crotch, basically, and they don't see anything and I feel good, then what's the point? I don't care what that number is, because I'm not going to say yes to treatment anyway. I don't want any side effects. Like if you say it like blooms and there's like, it's through the roof or it's, I feel great. So I'm going to say no for now. Anyway, so that's the shared decision-making I'm talking about. I'm having, I'm a bit of an unfair advantage, but I think that it is the only, as a physician, we are there to catalyze a conversation in a language that the patient understands, that is actually, they're the decision-maker, in my opinion. My job is to present the information. And occasionally, if I feel the person is in liminal, like not sure, then I say, well, if it was me, this is what I would do. Sometimes I'll say that, right? If it was me, I would say I would forget about the scan, or I would do it in a month or whatever. You know, and I also say I'm a bit of a more of a risk taker. So, but you decide, you know, and so I think their shared decision making, sure, but it really should be, I'm setting up the patient to be the decision maker.
Sure, sure. I mean, you have to be able to give them the options that they would have and make sure that it fits their life, their values, their goals.
You know, by the way, I'm Canadian, so...
We noticed from your accent.
Oh, really? I thought it was you with the accent. It's not a business here that way, right? I don't get more money if I sell someone an MRI for their headache. In fact, it slows things down for us. So our goal is to keep healthcare accessible to as many people as possible. So in fact, I talk more people out of CT scans for their headache than I actually CT scan, because the scanner's full. But I will make space. We will make space. So, you know, I guess like there's that part sometimes is unsaid in some of the more maybe private ways of managing healthcare, where you kind of give people everything. And so there's, you know, we don't need to get into that side conversation, but it, I think decision making is best done by the patient with full, as much information as possible.
Okay. And you were saying that it's not just giving them options regarding, you know, this test or this procedure or this route for treatment. It's also taking into account that there's the emotional toll that constant testing and constant procedures and everything, and even the side effects, might have. And how do you handle that as a physician? And how do you personally take that into account? And how has that affected you as well?
I wrote a Substack on it, my Substack, which we'll get to at the end of the show, on scans. It's called scans. Like the subtitle is Scanxiety. Scanxiety.
Okay.
And it's called The Wolf in the Machine is the title of the essay. But it goes on to say just that urge to know as much as possible. Completely understandable. It's completely understandable. And given the choice, I would say 90%+ of people want to get the images, even if it's not going to change what we're going to do. mm-hmm. because they just want to know. Their body is a mystery to them, right? Mm-hmm. And they feel it's this crazy conflict that we have. We feel like we're living in this body, and it's with us most of the time, but eventually it's going to be against us, and we're going to get sick and we're going to die, right? It's so funny. We think we're this like brain and a body or whatever, but of course it's just highly intercalated every possible level, you know, right from the cellular level, right from the top of your eyebrow to the tip of your toe. They're getting these messages. They're just transferring messages all the time. It's one unit. So, you know, how do I handle it as a physician? You know, I realize I'm managing the patient's heart as well, right? So I want them mm-hmm. to feel they're cared for no matter what. And they come in with a headache and I know they're not going to be able to sleep because they're going to be worried about it because they looked on chat or cloud and they saw, oh yeah, there's a chance it could be a subarachnoid hemorrhage or something. Mm-hmm. I'll do the scan just to help their little heart out, right? So that, but I also say to them, you know, it's not going to stop with the scan, right? You're going to want an MRI after that, and then you're going to want to see a neurologist. It is, you just need to work on your anxiety as well. So I want people to feel cared for, number one. Number two, you know, I'm so lucky. People ask what it's like to come to work in my hospital after I get back from Doctors Without Borders or mm-hmm. Ethiopia. And it's like, oh, it's like working on the Starship Enterprise.
Oh, wow. So that dramatic. Yeah.
Okay. It is, I can get an MRI for a person and like mm-hmm. the same day or a CT scan in a couple hours, or someone gets into the trauma room, I can give them 20 units of blood mm-hmm. and then go to straight to the operating room. And there's a team of people just waiting there with their hands gloved and folded to put a suture in this person's heart, bleeding heart. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. I feel like, wow, we're so lucky. We've come so far so fast. Yeah. We're very blessed.
That's true. Did becoming a patient make you more patient in the emotional sense with your own patients? Or, of course, as an emergency doctor, you don't see them after the fact, but are you more patient now in the ER when you're seeing people?
Yes. Yes. I find the modern version, at least of emergency medicine, where we are measured on how many patients we see rather than how mm-hmm. well we see them, mm-hmm. probably the most avoidable cruelty in my work life. Meaning, when people want to ask me about solutions to overcrowding in the ER or whatever else is plaguing us, I say, whatever the answer is that gives me more time with patients, I want to spend more time with people, not less. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have to rush through. Because let me tell you, if I see someone who, I'll give you a vignette. Person comes in, they've stepped off the curb in high heel shoes, and they maybe broke their ankle. And they mm-hmm. got a swollen ankle, and they hobble into the ER. There are advanced directives or medical directives where the nurse knows in certain instances just to order the x-ray. If patient can't walk, order the x-ray and I'll look at the x-ray later and we'll decide. That way it saves me a step because the x-ray is done by the time I see the patient. So let's say I've seen a few patients, this woman with the ankle injury, I look at the x-ray, and there's no fracture, and I go into the room, it's a little bit swollen, I tell her to put ice on it, does she need crutches, she's got some at home, and I can just leave the room, and that's it. We'll call that clinical encounter 11 of the day, it's over. However, if I say, you know, why'd you trip? Mm-hmm. And she says, well, maybe I had too much to drink. And I say, oh yeah, you drinking a lot lately? She says, maybe. Okay, well, how many bottles of wine a day? 3. Wow, that's a lot. And, you know, and now we're talking about that, which is the real reason why she's in the ER. That's mm-hmm. the medicine, when the medicine starts. It's not the counting. It's not the superficial layer. It's the deeper kind of human layer. And then, so I, in terms of what's changed for me, I just see that so much more clearly. And I like to spend more, you know, by the way, I can go fast as well, but if necessary. But when the reciprocity happens is when I am able to go deeper. And so it's given me that urge to do that and permission, because you know what? Fire me. If it's like, my patients know they've got good care. And I know if you went toe-to-toe and you actually measured metrics that matter, how many patients came back the second time because they were confused about the instructions or didn't feel they were cared for, or I got it wrong and they needed to be admitted, I bet you that I am average or above average on that. We'll see.
Well, that's
Then overall, you're reducing anxiety, which can have following advantages there. And then you're also, if you are getting to the root cause, as you said, like if it's a substance abuse issue, you could be delaying or actually halting future issues right there, which could be, that makes a lot of sense.
And just showing that person kindness is sometimes medicine. It's the medicine.
Right. Because in our minds can do quite a bit in terms of, regulating what's going on. And that could be profound. As a doctor and a patient, how do you, when you go in for care, how do you, because patients often have an issue, as you said, like not quite understanding what they're hearing, and even, having that emotional block where you're not taking everything in. But how can patients keep track of the details, and how can patients I don't want to say a better job, but how can they get the most out of their appointments?
Mm-hmm. That's a big one. And thank you for bringing it up, because it's often the case that doctors and the healthcare professions probably overall will think, okay, what else can we do in order to improve the life in the ER? But I think that you're so right. And there is things that patients can do as well, and to help us out and make it simpler and more straightforward. You know, the very simple, which is bring all your medicines, a list of all your medicines and the doses, because that is very important for us, because I want to constantly scan that for, well, opportunities to have the medicines as explanation for the reason why you're there, okay? Mm-hmm. To interaction. Sometimes medicines get added. They rarely get taken away, and I love to take medicines away if I can, because people maybe don't need them, et cetera, et cetera. Then like a past history of what has gone on in terms of just like bullet points, surgeries and medical conditions. Allergies, that just helps us a lot with the initial processing. And then, I don't know if there's a role here for AI, but I certainly give patients permission to record if they're maybe wanting to go through this again and with a bit of, a translation with the help of a friend or a physician or AI, et cetera. But feel empowered as much as possible to ask questions about, whatever is less clear to you, and ask things, because a lot of the time, if someone comes in, let's say they come in with a heart arrhythmia, and I'll go in and I'll lean over because I teach medicine as well as practice it. I'll go in and I'll listen to the medical student or the resident talk to the patient about their heart arrhythmia. And almost always they say, you have atrial fibrillation. And I'm like, okay, they don't know what that is, right? You must say it because they'll hear it again. Okay, definitely say it. But you must go further than that. You say, okay, the heart usually beats like this. And now your heart's going like that, because the timing is off, and that happens. Or, it's a common arrhythmia as we age, et cetera. And, then you see the kind of like their eyes like, okay, I can understand that. Mm-hmm. By the way, sometimes they're medical sophisticates and they already know what it is, and they looked it up on ChatGPT and they already got it on lock. But the role of the physician to the patient is kind of teacher, mm-hmm. in a certain ways, teacher as both the body, and then the patient is there to participate in this relationship. And I'll often say to people, like, now you and I are in a relationship now. It's something called the doctor-patient relationship. It's a very special relationship. And in it, I will work to the best of my knowledge and resources on hand in your best interest. That's my responsibility. But you have a responsibility too. And your responsibility is to tell me the truth as much as you know it, okay, about mm-hmm. what's going on with your body. And the second is, now then you got to take responsibility for, after we leave here, for doing what's next. Meaning, if I prescribe penicillin for your strep throat, you got to take the whole thing. So mm-hmm. that otherwise it's not a relationship that's going to work out. If you don't tell me the truth or you don't take responsibility, then I'm going to put this, it's not, I'm going to pour all this stuff into this relationship and nothing's going to happen. So you need those two things. So that's like from the very granular medication list, et cetera, to like making sure you understand and are able to take some responsibility for whatever the next steps are.
All right. When you say stage four cancer, many of our listeners may immediately think of hopelessness based on TV shows or wherever they get their info. How do you think about prognosis without letting it define everything?
Yeah. So stage four in this instance would be it's escaped my thyroid and it's somewhere. Yeah. You know, sometimes people get diagnosed with stage four where it's escaped the thyroid, for instance, or the bowel or whatever, and it's in their brain and their liver and their bones and all that stuff, right? And of course, that's fatal soon after, unfortunately, right? Most of the time. Not always, okay? We're having some great successes with immunotherapy now, and it's very interesting landscape. Cancer in particular, things that we didn't think were solvable are becoming more studied, etc. But, you know, as my friend Calvin, I called him and I told him and how I was going through this. He's a lovely friend and a poet. And I said, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like I'm going to die. He said, you know, even on what you think is the last day of your life, you don't know if you're going to die. It's not up to you. And I'm like, okay, yeah. So in that way, that part is taken care of. The dying is taken care of. Now, what's up for me is a living. Mm-hmm. And that I get to choose. And I'm alive. For now. It's not always going to be the case, obviously. But I'm alive for now. And so I choose living. And sure, you've got the anxious animal. We're anxious animals. So my mind ponders into the future and thinks, okay, what about if it's in your liver or in your chest or worse, you got another surgery in your neck, which I've had, by the way, second one. But I just don't live there. I'm living my life. Mm-hmm. And I live here. And after we're done, I'm going to make myself a sandwich. You know, and that's like kind of more like accomplishable. So that's where, you know, prognosis is just, you don't know. You don't know. And you can spontaneously remit. Some cancers can spontaneously remit. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time they don't. Okay, mm-hmm. So that's, but you don't know, right?
Do you ever feel anger at becoming the patient after spending your life as a doctor?
Yes, absolutely. Guilt. Guilt that I let this happen to me somehow. I did it to myself. And shame that I did it to myself, that I got had enough, that I got sick. It made me think, well, do I hold it against my patients too for being sick? Oh, and maybe at a subtle level I do, because I certainly held it against myself.
And how do you process that guilt?
Still processing.
Okay.
You know, these things, I don't know if you're familiar with the Buddhist term samskaras, these kind of like, it's almost like a palimpsest of experience, right? So mm-hmm. your childhood, your parents' childhood, their ancestors, kind of create these kind of like patterns that are riven into your experience, cognitive experience. And mine, certainly, I'm very quick with the guilt and the shame. Mm-hmm. So, you know, will I ever have an answer about how to? No, but I do feel it less because I forgive myself, even if that's the case. Which, you know, and it wasn't the case, by the way. It was just a random mutation. Mm-hmm. But there's a part of me, the kind of lovely part of us that gets to grow our whole life long if we're patient and we let it, is this part of us that, I don't know, kind of loves self-love, mm-hmm. of all the flaws even. I'm not talking mm-hmm. like adoring myself and staring in the mirror at myself or anything like that. I just mean more often I just let myself, you know, being human. I'm just a human being. I'm frail at times and emotionally and one day physically and yeah, so just permission to be is the way that it's been able to kind of work with the guilt and the shame.
And I think that's a big step to give yourself that permission. Mm-hmm. And a challenging step. Mm-hmm. And how has that affected how you teach medical students and how you view and ask them to view the doctor-patient relationship?
That's funny. I mean, I've been teaching medicine for 22 years now.
Okay.
And I go through different phases where I'm a very, you know, it's kind of comes in waves where I'm very passionate and then I kind of get more into patients, meaning I just want to spend time with patients. I don't want to explain why I'm doing what I do. I just want to hang out with my patients. And so I say to students lately, on the first time we're working together, I say, okay, what's the number one rule in medicine? And a lot of the time they'll say non-maleficence, which is do no harm.
Do no harm, first, right.
First rule. Mm-hmm. And I say, nope, it's have a good time. Because if you don't have a good time, you're not going to want to come back. So make sure you have a good time. Get to know your patients. At least one person you should be able to say, oh, I like your shoes, or find something to talk about that's not the thing, just for yourself and mm-hmm. and for them, and get to know them and care about them and take a break when you need it, and I hope you find it as cool as I do. And so I think that sets people up for a different experience mm-hmm. of being with people. It's like, no, it's the notion of patient-centered care for me has always been a lie. It can only be human-centered care, and it has to work both ways. So, sure, you're taught from the very early stage. You know, I remember being up at, like, staring at my pager, right, right from the go, right, in medical school. You get a pager, and you're like, well, what is this? Kind of it's like a handling a bomb, you know? It's going to go mm-hmm. off at any time, and it will. And then it goes off thousands of times and kind of beats into you this ethos that, you know, no matter what time of day or night, you get paged and you answer that call and you don't say what, you say, how can I help you? It's way better. Number two mm-hmm. is way better than number one.
Mm-hmm.
It's just for you.
Well, and that's a so big you, shift from that's a big shift from the models where physician was seen as the sole authority and, you know, the patient was just someone that sat there.
Yeah.
There was yeah. no, there was no back and forth. There was no interaction.
Very hierarchical, right?
Right.
Completely hierarchical. Right. It still is, you know, because we have our own language, right? We have our own dress. It's almost like a cult-ish, you know what I mean? Not always, okay? By the way, my patients, a lot of them call me Dr. James just because my last name is hard to remember. And I don't wear a white coat. I once did. But it can be confusing, obviously, for people. And then you know, we play off that hierarchy, and it's satisfying. Being in a hierarchy is great when you're at the top. But you know, it's not ultimately, I need to be trusted by my patients and for the medicine to work. Mm-hmm. When I was doing this, researching this book that I'm so slowly working on, one could almost call it glacial. But I have a first draft to my editor. It's my third memoir. But it's about this experience. And I pitched to my editor. I said, okay, I feel Western medicine doesn't quite have it right. We always like to break patients into organs, basically. Here's a nephrologist. Here's an ophthalmologist. But it's all one system. I learned it. I did physiology. It was my first love. And so I know it's all intercalated and interrelated. So I said, okay, I want to go travel. I want to go to like the zenith of Western medicine, which is in America, and I want to see what's possible with all of the bells and whistles. And I want to fly to India and study, like be a patient in all these systems, in Ayurvedic medicine, and then naturopathy, and then go through Tibet into China, and Tibet, because it's on the high plain, there's less plants, so the medicine becomes more metaphysical and spiritual, and then you go back into China, and it's much more back to plants and herbs and et cetera, et cetera. And then end up in indigenous knowledge keepers in my own country and make something like a compass of medicine such that I could see what, I don't know, just what we were missing. Is there a different way to think about the body, energy, archetypes, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I never got a chance to answer that question in the same, as many ways as I like, because I felt that lymph node in my neck and COVID came and stormed through the world and all that stuff. And so the memoir itself is one of a tale of hubris more than anything else. But I did get a chance to work with knowledge keepers, indigenous knowledge keepers in Canada. And one of them, Rick Favelle, has since passed away, but he was saying, okay, here's some medicines for you, and you must have, they must have been picked in a particular way, which is you wouldn't take the last of the plant, for instance. You'd want it to thrive, and it wants you to thrive in the same way. And if you can't find, you're not sure how it was picked, let's say he recommended this kind of herb that he didn't have on hand, then it should be blessed. You should bless it and get someone to bless it. And just so it has maximum effect. And I just thought, oh, what's so much different. He said, you know, your system will take like get an active in chemical and they'll just synthesize it and they'll make it in a lab and then they'll make it in a factory. But there's no intention to heal. There's intention to make money. And so it doesn't have the full power because the intention to heal and it's a separate thing, right? It's an important thing. It can't just be this one little congener molecule. There you go. Now it's medicine. It's like, no, it's a whole other, there's a whole other lot of stuff going on there that you don't, that in his system runs alongside of it. And I imagine like what if I would give the patient a prescription for doxycycline for maybe their Lyme disease or something. And we just spent a second with our hand on the paper and said, may this medicine heal you with kindness or whatever it is. Okay. And I bet you could study it. And I bet you those patients take all 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. So there, what is that? You know, we miss that in Western medicine. That's considered too airy fairy or whatever the right word is, right? And but it's very real. What happened is real. That patient's going to take all those medicines.
Well, and even what you said earlier about explaining to the patient that you want the doctor-patient relationship to be a relationship and that they have responsibilities and you need to work with them, I think that could have an equally profound effect. Mm-hmm. And it can make all the difference because I think a lot of times we are handed that prescription and just the fact that we're given the prescription, we can kind of take as, oh, well, now we're healed. But it's not just the words on the page. It's actually, you know, taking that to the pharmacy, filling it at the pharmacy and making sure that we're taking that medication as prescribed. And it's more than just just the words. It's the intention. It's everything involved. And it's, it's a whole system. It's not just a one-way track. And it is, it's very complex. And I think taking into consideration that a person is more than, it's not just them. It's also their relationships, their family, their friends that are also going to play a role in their lives. And that those individuals can have a profound effect on how they perceive medicine and how well the outcomes for them can be. It just, families can be a challenging and a very beneficial effect on someone's overall health care.
For sure.
What are some of the challenges that you faced as a physician, and then some of the challenges that you faced as a patient when it comes to patients' families and then your own family as, you know, as you yourself are a patient?
Yeah, you know, obviously there's so diverse experiences in the world, and the ER collects them all. And so I'll see families who are very motivated to care for their elderly loved one, and I'll see families who are really just want to drop them off at the hospital and go away for a week or something because they don't want to do that or they burned out from doing it. I feel even probably more since the pandemic, there is distrust on the some overall, and with patients feeling they need to protect themselves somehow from the medical profession as well. So I think that that's more common. So you can kind of feel like they want to make sure that their family member is getting the best care because sometimes medicine cannot be trusted. I think that is occurring. So you can find families being a bit more skeptical and protective, I think. And that could be a challenge. And, you know, for my own family, my dad, soon to be 82, somewhere around there, 81. And doing pretty well overall for, where he's living alone in the house him and my mom built the year before my birth. So a long time ago. And just finding someone to care about him is hard. You know, it's like just a doctor, like, what, your doctor just saw you for 2 minutes with the back pain and ordered an x-ray? X-rays are a waste of time for 80-year-old back pain. You don't want an x-ray or just an x-ray. You want to continue to investigate, for instance. So that's the challenge. It's like, how do you get, you know, it's hard to find someone who cares. And but I'm so blessed. My family's very loving and very supportive and, you know, all that stuff. So I'm blessed.
Well, I'm happy to hear that. Yeah. And I know family and friends can make a huge difference. And I will say, and this is off point, but here in the United States, there's a well-established sense of mistrust in certain populations when it comes to medicine. And there's definite root causes for that. And it's still, you know, there still are problems. And when certain groups and certain populations are, you know, have significantly higher mortality rates for the same conditions that other populations, you know, are, you know, don't have that same mortality rate, there's problems in the system. And in the way that everything is handled and the way even things are taught, and then but it is about reestablishing trust and putting into ensuring that, you know, that the possible biases that are there and there certainly are eliminated whenever possible, and that we learn from historical mistakes, and then that we teach about those historical mistakes so that they aren't repeated is really important and really hard to contend with. And then when, and that's something I know that we continue to face here in the United States, and it's something that has to be faced. Otherwise, you know, just avoiding it is probably not the right way forward. And unfortunately, in the current climate, it is
disservice to the patients.
Yeah, it is a definite disservice that it, where instead of saying, here's what happened, here's why people feel the way that they do, and here's what we're trying to do to fix it, we're just trying to eliminate the history itself and pretending that it never occurred, which is kind of shocking.
Right. Yeah, or even like refusing to measure it. You know, it really is, it comes back down to hierarchy, doesn't it?
Right.
So the hierarchy serves people at the top. Mm-hmm. And there is absolutely no appetite for changing it. Mm-hmm. Why would you? It's profitable for you. It means you get better care overall. You can afford the better care. But, you know, the real reason is a deeper thing we were talking about at the beginning. It's that soft, loving part of yourself that is not, mm-hmm. that is emerges when safety, or when you come in contact with that deeper thing within us that is working on something that's thousands of generations long. And you realize that there's, you know, that's the growth is to, I don't know how to get there. I wish I did. I think conversations like this are part of it, but you want to let people know that creating a health system that is effective and efficacious and for all people in your country or the world, let's say, mm-hmm. okay, is the most beautiful goal. Mm-hmm. And that means that your kid who's walking home from the soccer pitch and gets hit by a car and their phone's broken and they got no ID and they're all dirty and they look like they could be a street urchin can go to the nearest ER and get whatever life-saving care they need, and we don't have to worry about how much money they have or who they are. Mm-hmm. That's how reassuring, how well would you sleep if that was the case?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we need at the deepest level.
Right.
It's not, that's what we need. That's what we must get to that place.
Well, James, before we close, if you could speak directly to someone that was newly diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, what would you say?
Well, I have. And mm-hmm. I say, I know that's a hard thing for you to hear, and there's a lot of stuff going on, but it was there yesterday. We just didn't know, but now we know.
Right.
And now we can start to do stuff about it. Isn't that cool?
Yes.
Here's what we're going to do. Here's the first step. Okay. We're going to make sure that we probably need a biopsy and figure out what the quality is of this cell. And then we're going to see what medicines we have on it. And we're going to kind of walk with you through this time. So don't worry about that part of it. And I would say personally, as someone who's been through this experience, my motivation, my hope and my intention I set for myself is to not internalize the conflict, because these are just my cells. This is just me. Okay. It's just me. And it's kind of lost a bit of integrity of the rest of the body, but I don't want to internalize this conflict of me against me. So what I'm going to do is I intend to show these cells the best possible time that they've ever had, so they know how great it is to be alive.
Mm-hmm.
And don't forget it. And so I think, you know, those points would be what I would pass along is, excellent. Now we know, and then here's what we're going to do. We're going to see it through.
And James, where can our listeners learn more about you, find your Substack, and get copies of your memoir, and then get information as far as when your next memoir will be released?
I think my editor is waiting for that information as well. But
I was going to say, your editor and our editor should talk, because I'm sure they could. Yeah. They need a support group.
Yeah, they think they do. They're very patient people, thank goodness. I thought patients were patient, but the editors do. Yeah, so Dr. Heal Thyself on Substack. Dr:HealThyself, James Miskolic, you can search me there. And I'm putting out essays pretty much on the weekly as somewhat of a book avoidance strategy. And then my memoirs, I mean, should I say Amazon? You can just go start there. But you can just find them by Googling my name. And the first one is about the first mission I did with Doctors Without Borders in Sudan and kind of how that affected me seeing that and trying to come back home and trying to figure out what people were talking about here. And the second is back and forth between emergency rooms in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, the one I work at in inner city Toronto, and then with my grandfather in northern Alberta. And so it's kind of moving through those worlds. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, please come. And I'd love to have the ongoing conversation that's possible these days with readers and listeners.
And can I ask you one more question? What would you say to a medical student or other healthcare providers who are curious about doing work in other areas and potentially overseas and potentially in areas, with an organization such as Doctors Without Borders?
I consider it the best medicine, and there's an urgency to not only do it, but to make the need to do it obsolete. Mm-hmm. Meaning, as much as I love Doctors Without Borders, I want to create a world where we don't need them. And sure, actually, healthcare systems are resilient. And that system you and I were talking about earlier, where anyone can get into it at any time, no matter who they are or how much money they have, that's the goal. But when bombs start falling, I'm just drawn to go to these countries or near them and say, hey, I'm James. Mm-hmm. I'm from Canada. How can I help you? Mm-hmm. And because that people need to know that too, because right now it just seems very cruel that we're kind of standing idly by. So my advice to students is you must do it. You should do it. Okay. Mm-hmm. To work in, as you pointed out, you can also find ways to engage with more social issues closer to home as well too. That's okay.
Sure.
But I consider it kind of probably the most sincere expression of the deepest underlying principles in medicine is to go to people who otherwise would not have care and say, how can I help you?
Thank you.
Yeah, that says a lot and means a lot. Mm-hmm. Thank you ever so much for taking the time. We really, really appreciate it. We know your time is extraordinarily precious, and we appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today.
Pleasure. It was fun. Thanks for the good questions. It was nice to reflect.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. This podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, and always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a healthcare regime. And never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard in this podcast.
Till next week.